Welcome to Facts Roundtable, a podcast dedicated to navigating life with food allergies across the lifespan, presented in a welcoming format with interviews and open discussions. Each episode will explore a specific topic, leaving you with the facts to know or use. Information presented via this podcast is educational and not intended to provide individual medical advice. Please consult with your personal board-certified allergist or healthcare providers for advice specific to your situation. Hi, everyone. I'm Caroline Mwasisi, and I am your host for the Fact Roundtable podcast. I am a food allergy parent, advocate, and the founder of the Grateful Foodie blog, and I am Fact's Vice President of Community Relations. Before we start today, I just want to give a heartfelt thank you to Genentech for sponsoring the Fact Roundtable podcast. Please note that today's guest was not sponsored by Genentech or compensated in any way by the sponsor to participate in this specific podcast. Today, we're exploring life with eosinophilic gastrointestinal disorders, also known as EGIDs, with the president and founder of the Cured Foundation, Ellen Kodroff. She will also discuss the importance of research, clinical trials, and lifestyle, including how students manage these different conditions while at school. Welcome, Ellen, to Facts Roundtable podcast. We're absolutely delighted and thrilled you're here with us today. I know you are so busy, so I truly, truly appreciate your time. And I'm very excited to learn more about your foundation and what you do and you and your work. So welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're going to dive straight in. But before we get talking too far, your background is amazing. If you don't mind telling people your background and information about your organization, the Campaign for Urging Research for Eosinophilic Disease, also known as CURED.
Sure. So I have three daughters who are all grown and now a grandson. By degree, I was a teacher. When my youngest daughter was 10 years old, she was diagnosed with eosinophilic gastroenteritis. And like most people, even now, maybe, never have heard of it. We never heard of it. We didn't know what it was. We were really worried that my daughter was going to be diagnosed with celiac disease. When the doctor came out of the endoscopy, he told us he didn't think it was celiac disease, but took biopsies. 5 days later, we get our diagnosis. And the next thing they did was allergy testing, and they did the blood RAS test for, I think, 10 foods and came back and told us she was allergic to 8 of the foods and that she needed to remove egg, wheat, soy, dairy, peanut, orange, corn, quite a few foods that she would no longer be able to eat. And obviously, this was shocking news. And the doctor saw 5 patients with this disease and led me to the internet at that time. This was 20 years ago, brought me to Cincinnati Children's Hospital. We then reached out and they had us send records and told us that, you know, they would like to see my daughter and told us that she may never eat again after we went there. She had been off those foods for 3 months and really wasn't any better. You know, at that point, I was pretty naive to research, even the rare disease world. And I asked, you know, what were they doing to find a treatment for this disease? Because they didn't seem to know very much about it at the time. And they told me there were no funds for research. And I just assumed a hospital funded research. So I was pretty shocked to hear that. And they said, basically, a hospital funds research for the first year. And then researchers are kind of on their own to get their own funding. I looked at the doctor and I said, how much do you need? And he said, $1 million would be a good place to start. And I said, I don't know where or how, but I will get you that $1 million somewhere, somehow. I came home. I asked my friends and family if they would help me start a foundation to raise money for research for this rare disease my daughter was just diagnosed with. And that's how CURED began. So we're CURED, Campaign Urging Research for Eosinophilic Diseases. 20 years later down the road, CURED has donated very close to $7 million to research. And we partner with not only Cincinnati Children's Hospital, but I believe we just donated to our 10th or 11th clinic. I know I should know that, but it's one of the two. And we host education conferences every other year. We work with Cincinnati Children's Hospital on our education conference. Our last one was in 2019 before COVID. We had doctors and researchers and patients from 9 countries and almost every state in the U.S. represented. We spread awareness. We advocate. We've had legislation passed for formula coverage in Illinois and other states. We're always there to support the emotional needs of families going through these diseases because it's very difficult, as you know, whether you have a food allergy or an eosinophilic disease or any kind of chronic disease that people don't really understand, it's always nice to have the support of somebody who lives it and understands it on a personal level. So, and we are 100% volunteer. We have no paid employees. We just work off of anybody who is willing to help in any way we can get them to help, to volunteer some hours here and there to create this foundation and keep it running. And, you know, our main mission is to be able to support research in hope of a better treatment and a cure. And, you know, through that, we've been lucky to work with industry and FDA and researchers, and everybody really is very interested in hearing the patient voice now. So it goes a long way for sure.
This is incredible. And you know, I always tell my friends, never underestimate the power of a passionate person, especially a mom. This is amazing, learning about how much you've been able to raise over the years. And I love that you're offering such wonderful support to everyone, because you're right, it feels so lonely when you get a diagnosis that you don't understand and you don't see it commonly. So that's so, so vital. So now, since you're the expert and we have you right here, what types of eosinophil-associated disease does your organization work with? And I know before we actually came on, you were talking about this wide breadth of area that it covers. So if you don't mind bringing all of us up to speed on that.
Sure. So when we first started, the main eosinophilic diseases that we worked with were the eosinophilic gastrointestinal diseases. So that's eosinophilic esophagitis, eosinophilic gastritis, eosinophilic duodenitis, and eosinophilic colitis. And, you know, now years later, but not so far after, my daughter was diagnosed with hypereosinophilic syndrome. So that was a focus of our research. And some of the drugs that we work with and research are overlapping for so many of the other eosinophilic diseases. Actually, now we have many, many members of our support group that have eosinophilic asthma. And a lot of our funding has gone to research for these drugs that are also overlapping with eosinophilic asthma. We actually had our first FDA-approved drug for eosinophilic esophagitis just passed this past May by the FDA, Dupixent. You know, that's been passed for eosinophilic asthma for several years now and for eczema. So these diseases kind of all overlap with the same medications. So our research dollars are going a long way to find better treatments for all of these diseases, actually.
That has to feel good to see that hard work coming to fruition. You know, and again, I just believe that passion is what helps drive, you know, some of this change. So congratulations on that. Now, this question may be a really hard one in a sense because it's so broad, but can you give us like a short basic primer of these different types of diseases and what a patient might experience, just so we can get a feel for what it's like?
Sure. So when somebody has eosinophilic esophagitis, I think some of the main symptoms are choking on your food, feeling like an impaction, having an impaction, not feeling an impaction, but where food would get stuck in your esophagus when you eat. When we first started CURED, most of the people that we would see looking for support were parents of children. However, now I would say it's really equal to the amount of adults being diagnosed versus the amount of children. Adults are going to the ER with food impactions. The ER doctors are learning that they need to scope these patients and they need to take biopsies, and they're being diagnosed also in alarming rates. Adults are. If you notice somebody's drinking a glass of water in between each bite of food, that might be a sign they might have an eosinophilic disease. Somebody coughing while they eat because they're feeling the food getting stuck in their esophagus. They can actually feel it going down. And people who have lived with this for quite a long time might not even realize that it's a symptom or that everybody is not feeling the same thing that they're feeling. Another part of the whole digestive disease would be feeling nauseous. Sometimes a lot of patients are complaining of joint pain, body aches, headaches, vomiting, severe stomach pain, diarrhea, failure to thrive, low iron counts. My daughter was first diagnosed because her hemoglobin was really low, and that's what brought us to a GI doctor. They were thinking possibly celiac, like I said. So, you know, all of these things can be symptoms. Now, when you have hypereosinophilic syndrome, you would have really elevated eosinophils in your blood. So when they take a CBC and then you look at your eosinophil count, I believe 0 to 7 is normally the normal range for most labs. If it's 15 or over for a consecutive 6 months, then it's definitely something to rule out. You know, like I say to people, don't think you automatically have these diseases, but if you're seeing these symptoms or you're having this blood work, then you definitely need to rule out these diseases because they are definitely more common than they ever were before. You know, patients that have chronic asthma, so severe, you make sure that your doctor's checking for eosinophilic asthma. Like I said, there's now these approved drugs that are really working. There's several for asthma, eosinophilic asthma. There's several drugs in the works for hypereosinophilic syndrome. You know, so there are people that are definitely feeling some relief from these diseases, which is all very new within the past 5 years, where they really are finding better treatments for these diseases.
So I'm assuming there is no cure, kind of similar to food allergies. There is no cure, but there's management of and then treatment.
Right. Unfortunately, with this disease, you can go into remission, like from food elimination diet, maybe if you have EOE or EOG, and that could change after time. So even if you find your triggers of what foods are causing it and you go into remission, it's not saying 3 years down the road, a trigger is not going to change and that food is going to start to make you ill again and take you out of remission. I mean, one of my daughter's safe foods for years, and people can't believe it, was shrimp. That was her only safe protein. And people are like, shrimp? Because eosinophilic disease is not really an allergic reaction to food. It's more of an intolerance to food. You know, that's why shrimp, it could be a safe food, even for somebody who has food allergies or eosinophilic disease, rather. And then all of a sudden, after it really being her only safe protein for 8 years, it started making her sick and she could no longer have shrimp. And unfortunately, because my daughter was diagnosed 20 years ago and there wasn't the kinds of treatments there are now, she did have to remove many foods from her diet for a very, very long time. And she is now anaphylactic to dairy and wheat. And so those are two foods that it's really, really hard not to get crust contamination from. I do believe that patients being diagnosed now are in a little bit better of a place because most patients will not have to remove food for this period of time that she did, because we do have, you know, some medications and better treatments than we had over the years.
So now turning to the treatment and diagnosis, who is the person who makes that diagnosis? So would a patient go see an allergist or a gastroenterologist or a pediatrician? Who should they seek out?
Well, a GI for sure, because the only way to diagnose an EGID, an EGID, would be through a biopsy, an endoscopy, or colonoscopy. Multiple biopsies have to be taken. And this is where even physicians don't really know the protocol of finding a diagnosis, because patients go in and they feel symptoms, and maybe their allergist recommended they go get an endoscopy because they're showing symptoms of this disease. And the doctor will take one or two biopsies, and there's protocols to follow. And so for anybody who thinks they might have this disease, it's never a bad thing to say to the GI before you go under anesthetic and say, you know, please take four biopsies from each part of my esophagus, eight from my stomach, four from my small intestines, and four from my colon, if you're doing a colonoscopy, because a lot of doctors won't do this. And then unfortunately, patients go undiagnosed. You know, that is really, really important. And during your journey of these diseases, it is important, I think, and I think the doctors believe, that you do follow a GI, of course. They're the only one who could monitor that disease. And then many people see an allergist. Sometimes they do allergy testing, kind of for a guideline of what may be causing your GI upset. You know, it doesn't always mean if you're not allergic. There's patients who show no food allergies at all, yet end up having to remove all food from their diet, you know, so that just depends. But an allergist is somebody, you know, most patients are followed by. And then it's always a good idea to see a dietitian, because you're removing and adding so many foods, and it's hard to figure out what foods have what ingredients in them. So a dietitian can help you, you know, determine, like, just because you can't have soy, most patients are allowed to have soy lecithin. Most patients are allowed to have soybean oil. Working with a dietitian, and obviously, you know, check that out with your doctor. Don't say Ellen said, but, you know, normally that is the case. And oftentimes with this disease, because it is so life-altering, that it's not a bad idea for an adult or a child to see a social worker or a therapist who works with patients with chronic disease, because obviously our world revolves around food. Everywhere you look, you know, it's celebrations for happy occasions, sad occasions, no matter what the occasion is, there's some kind of food involved. And so many patients feel very isolated because they cannot eat, no matter what age you are. So
you are a wealth of knowledge. You are incredible. And looking at you and all that knowledge, so if someone does suspect they might have one of these diseases, what's the best way for them to learn about it, so when they do speak to their physician, they have a little knowledge?
Well, they definitely could go to curedfoundation.org for information on the disease. Anyone can always feel free to reach out to me. My contact is on the website, curedfoundation.org. I'm happy to either email with somebody or to take a phone call at any time. I'm always happy to help. There's also Seeger, C-E-G-I-R, Seeger.org. Seeger is a consortium of doctors from, well, now around the world, I could say, because I believe we have a doctor from Switzerland, part of Seeger. You know, it's a consortium of doctors that are working together, that were given a grant by the NIH for rare diseases, and they work together to do research, eosinophilic diseases. They have a great website also with great information. We have support groups on social media also. If you're on Facebook and you look us up, Cured Foundation, we have a Facebook page you could follow. We have a support group with close to 16,000 members. It's not for industry. It's not for FDA. This private support group is just for patients and their families, and trying to keep it a safe place. Sometimes people, you know, have questions about certain doctors or things like that. So we do try and keep it a safe place for patients and their families to be able to talk about all aspects of the disease. And for physicians or industry that we work very close with also, you know, they can follow us on our Facebook page.
And listeners, I will make sure that I have all these links and websites listed in the show notes because I don't want you to miss anything. This is a lot of wonderful knowledge. So now, as you know, FACT focuses on food allergies. And so with food allergies, every year we encourage everyone to establish 504 accommodations for their children, K through 12 at schools. And so we basically know what that looks like accommodation-wise. Now, what should a parent or caregiver take into consideration if they have a child living with these eosinophil diseases?
I would encourage them to do the same thing. To get a 504 plan, we have information about that also on the Cured Foundation website. You know, there's oftentimes, unfortunately, we don't have centers of excellence in every state. So many people need to travel out of state for care. So if you're flying or driving 5 or 6 hours, it's not going to be a one day off of school. It's going to end up to be 2 to 3, maybe even longer off school every time you have to get scoped. If you have a doctor following your case, you may have to be scoped or your child every 3 months. So that's quite a lot of scopes, and it's also quite a lot of time to miss school. And you want to protect your child, that he is given ample amount of time to finish work when he's, you know, away for medical. You know, you're not getting an endoscopy and doing homework that night because you're probably not going to feel well. Or if you're prepping for a colonoscopy, you're probably not going to want to do homework the night before. So you want to make sure that you're covered, you know, during that time. Also, I know, you know, for my daughter, especially when she got to high school, a lot of times she didn't feel well, was either late at night, so she wasn't getting a good night's sleep, and then would have to get up early in the morning for school, or she didn't feel well first thing in the morning. Those were probably her worst times. In her 504, we always put that we wanted her to have study hall first period and then PE second period so that she wasn't missing a major academic class if she had a sleep in or if she didn't feel well in the morning. Also, if you don't feel well at school, you don't need to go home every time. Even if you vomit, I mean, most schools will send you home because they think you have a flu or a virus, but the child usually knows. They know their body pretty well. You know, if my daughter could just go and rest for 20 minutes and then she would feel better to go back to class, we wanted to make sure that she had the right to decide if she wanted to stay in school or she wanted, you know, to call to be picked up. That we would leave that choice to her. Things like even in high school, you know, if my daughter emailed the teacher at night and said, I'm sorry, I'm really sick tonight, I can't study for my test, you know, she would automatically get to take the test the following day. And, you know, I guess it depends on the child. She didn't take advantage of the situation. So there was never a case where they doubted her or thought she was just saying that because she didn't want to take a test. And it all worked very well for her. And from what I hear with other people, you know, if you approach the situation kind of in a kinder way, like not thinking you're not going to get your accommodations, you know, just letting people know what it's like living with this disease, as far as administration and who you have to talk to about your 504, I think it goes easier than when people, you know, go in explaining this is the law and this is what you have to do, you know, because people are on the defense because you think they're going to argue with you. So my recommendation is go in kindly, asking for what you need, and then take it from there, I guess, if things don't quite go your way. But we have a list of things that you can ask for. And we also have attorney advocates at our conference. We have an attorney that speaks about the patient's rights. I mean, as a student, the student's rights. I mean, you know, sometimes you do have to show some legal backing or, you know, things aren't going the way you would like them to go. So we have help like that on our website, too, and printable information for you to bring to the school to kind of explain to the school what this is. It's really hard for people to understand what this disease is that is not living with it.
And again, I will make sure I have every link that you're mentioning, because this is golden. This is absolutely golden information. So I will make sure, listeners, you can get everything that you need. So now let's turn to research, because you've obviously really impacted that. So again, how long and how deep has this relationship been with research? And is there specific types of research you focus in on?
Well, we are focusing in on research towards a better treatment, a cure, and better diagnostic tools. Like I said, patients, adults, and children, while monitoring your disease, you have to be scoped every 3 months. It's a lot of anesthesia. It's a lot of, you know, time off of work or missing school, like I said. So not only are we donating to research for better treatments, but better diagnostic tools. There is a string test where people swallow a string and they pull up the string and they can get tissue samples on the way of pulling the string out. And obviously you don't need to be put under to swallow a string. And, you know, that's something that CURE donated 2 years ago, and now they're starting to use it at multiple hospitals. We have donated to the transnasal endoscopy, which is they go up the nose. They freeze your nose, actually, so it's not supposed to be painful. I've not had it done, but you're awake. It's like a 15-minute procedure, you know, and they can actually go in and get biopsies, and you can go right to school after or right to work after because you're not put under anesthetic. So we want to see better diagnostics be available to patients. You know, there obviously will be some patients who will do what you just did and go like this, like put me under, I'd rather be sleeping. But there are other patients who, you know, for medical reasons, they can't have anesthesia or they get anxiety and the fear of being put under. So this way patients will have options. Also, you know, medical trials on drugs, it's very difficult for patients to even understand the different types of drug trials that there are and what it takes for them to be included in the trial. And sometimes, you know, my hotel and my travel will be paid for it. Other, you know, other trials, they don't even pay for your endoscopy. And all trials are backed by a drug company, most likely, if it's a drug trial. And so it's whatever that drug company, the pharmaceutical company, is willing to pay towards the trial, or if the, you know, if they're getting outside funding for some of the trial, you know, because a hospital, a doctor can't say, well, can we just waive the fee for the ER room or for the anesthesia or for, you know, it doesn't work like that. And unfortunately, some patients get frustrated because they still have expenses, but it just depends. And, you know, that's, you have to do your research too and make sure it's the right trial for you. Some trials you have to, you know, go every week for a month, and then it might be every other week, and then it might turn into once a month. And, you know, you have to have your injection, and then you might need to have a heart ultrasound every month to check to, you know, where they follow you, or an EKG or pulmonary function tests, you know, different kind of tests, because they're watching you very closely when you're in a drug trial. You know, some drug trials, you get that drug once you go on that trial until that drug is FDA approved. Other drug trials, as soon as the trial is over, the drug becomes unavailable to you again, even if it helped you. So you have to, you know, look into what drug trial you're thinking of going into and, you know, ask as many questions as you want, you know, before accepting it. Obviously, we will never have approved drugs if we don't get people to volunteer to do these drug trials. And I would say no one's putting you on a drug that they feel is going to hurt you or that they feel is very dangerous. By the time it's going to humans, it's been tested and it's known to be a safe drug. And, you know, they're not putting you in danger. Like right now, we're trying to recruit patients for our drug trial for eosinophilic gastroenteritis. Well, a lot of people who have that also have eosinophilic esophagitis. So if they could get Dupixent for EOE, short for eosinophilic esophagitis, why should they be in the drug trial and have to go through all the protocol of the drug trial? Well, like I just said, for one, we won't get drugs approved if people don't do the trial. And not everybody has both, unfortunately. So we have to, you know, not only always think of ourselves, but think of the whole patient community. And also, you're getting the drug for free. You're getting scoped for free. You're getting the best doctors out there monitoring your case closely, watching everything you're doing. You're being treated by the best physicians out there working on these diseases. So those are perks you're not getting. And you have no copay for the drug because you're getting the drug for free in the trial. So these are all little perks that you're going to get from being in a drug trial, even if the drug is available through a different avenue for you. I just encourage people to at least listen to what their doctors have to say about a drug trial if you're presented with, you know, being a good candidate for one, because like I said, we need these better treatments and a cure, and it will never happen, even with all the money in the world, if we don't have patients who are offering and volunteering to be part of this. And CURED really helps recruit for as many different studies as we know about. We also help a lot of pharmaceutical companies want to reach out to the patient community to see what's needed by the patient. So we help recruit for surveys and things like that. And you know, most of the pharmaceutical companies are very generous to reimburse patients for their time of answering these questions, but we're always helping to try and find patients who are willing to give of themselves, even for reimbursement for their time, but to participate in these surveys because they help, especially with quality of life questions. And that's something a lot of our patient community suffers from. So I highly encourage looking into it, asking questions, asking your doctors, looking on our website to see what is available, always sharing them on our social media pages, because it is making a difference. And we do share the patient's viewpoint all the time. So we let the drug companies know what our patient community needs. Actually, with EOE, when they were, you know, trying to recruit for drug trials, and the FDA wouldn't allow the age to drop under 18 for trials for Dupixent. And I was actually asked to be on a phone call with the FDA, explaining to them why they need to drop the age to 12. And really, I mean, you're talking about a disease that makes patients feel so isolated and so alone. In high school, junior high and high school, they're the hardest ages for a child with no outside issues. Just life itself during this age is difficult. So imagine the struggles of a child with these diseases. And, you know, when the FDA heard my stories, really, I think it took about 15 minutes and we got a call back saying that they approved the age till 12 years old because they listen and they care. And that's, you know, I think a miscommunications too. The patient community doesn't get to see what I get to see being part of this research. But when I tell you that the FDA, the industry, the pharmaceutical companies, the doctors, the researchers, I don't know if we're just very lucky, but the group of people that we work with, they do care so much about the patients and the patient's well-being and what the patients need and what they want. And our voices are being heard more than most people could ever imagine.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for the work that you're doing. Just as a fellow advocate, I am in awe because I agree with you. The voices need to be heard, but the patient is so busy handling their condition, or the caregiver is, that it's hard to realize that people want to hear. So thank you so much for becoming that bridge. you know, between these people who can actually carry out the change. And also, I personally believe that anyone participating in a trial is just a hero. I mean, just a flat out hero. So thank you so much again for all that detail. And so I will make sure people get the information to come to your website, but are there any other sources for them to find clinical trials that you feel are medically vetted and proper?
US.gov is a great place to look for clinical. All clinical trials are there. Obviously, the ones we're listing are by the drug companies that reach out to us or that physicians have reached out to us that we know about. We try and keep up with all of them, but definitely through the US.gov, which we have a link to from our website too, you know, you'll be able to find anything. And, you know, if ever there's symptoms or anything that you're unsure of, you know, like our website, the Seeger website, these support groups, you know, I always say, you know, listen with a grain of salt. Obviously, you're listening to patients and caregivers who are not physicians, but sometimes they know, I shouldn't say this, but sometimes they even know a little more than some of the doctors who don't really understand the disease. So, you know, just always check with your own doctor after reading anything, but it's a great place for information. It's a great place for support. I encourage people, you know, to join the support groups. You know, I know that the Cured support group is a very safe place for patients. We do monitor that group. We do try and be very careful about who we let in. You know, like I said, always check with your doctor before doing anything, but you're going to get a lot of information from these websites. There's always somebody sharing a story. If you have a symptom from a drug and you go on there and say, does anybody else have the symptom? Then you don't feel alone. You don't feel like, oh, maybe I'm just imagining this. You know, you're hearing other people that are sharing those same things that you're going through. I think it's quite helpful.
My allergist used to say that. He used to say, go find a support group, find other people who've walked the walk, and you will learn. Again, don't do anything medical without coming and talking to me first. He said, but you need to get out there and meet these other families and other people and learn how they're doing it, because you are going to, like you said, pick up these things that you might not have noticed or things that are happening to you, and now you're seeing other people are having the symptoms, so then you can go back to your doctor. So it is really important.
I know with my daughter, she was diagnosed at 10. So we went through all the stages. We went through grammar school and junior high and high school and going away to college and managing this disease in college. My daughter went 7 hours away. Now she was one of the patients who did have to remove all food from her diet when she was 14. She did not go on a feeding tube, which many of the patients who have to remove all food go on a feeding tube, and you may even have a doctor tell you that you don't have a choice, that your child won't drink formula. Well, talk to me. My child drank formula. She did not have a feeding tube and, you know, was able to do that. So just to hear another mother that has been through everything with their daughter, you know, and now she's moved. She's obviously graduated college. This is 20 years later. She has a great job. She's moved to LA. And so even with all her challenges, like I'm not saying, you know, stay home and cry because your kid has this disease. I'm saying they can do anything that they set their heart to do. And there are so many great accomplishments that patients with this disease could have. So it's not doom and gloom, even though it might sound scary. I could tell you that my daughter's life has been quite successful, even with all these challenges. And sometimes challenges make people more sensitive, and a different kind of person develops out of these challenges also. So,
well, you're very inspiring. I love that message of hope. And I can't even believe it, but our time is coming to an end. I could just sit here all afternoon chatting with you. But before we sign off, is there anything you would like the listeners to hear from you?
I guess if I could give people one piece of advice only, which obviously we've done a little more than that, was go to a center of excellence, at least for a second opinion, or if you're not finding yourself able to get a diagnosis. You know, you have to be your own advocate, and to go to a doctor who's seeing 500 patients versus a doctor who's seeing 5 patients, it's just going to make your journey easier to go to a doctor who understands the disease. And unfortunately, even though EoE doesn't seem rare anymore, these are still rare diseases. And it's not very easy. We have a professional page on our website again, you know, with where we believe the centers of excellence are and doctors that follow protocol for pediatrics and adults. So, you know, if you can't find a doctor or you feel like maybe your doctor isn't really understanding the disease, I really recommend that you go to a doctor who follows protocol and really understands the treatment of this disease.
Wonderful. Thank you again. Last time I'll say it, everyone needs to go to the show notes because I'm going to have every single link pulled out for you. So it'll be nice and easy. But thank you again, Ellen, for your time. Your work is amazing. Your passion is just totally exciting. I mean, I just want to get out there and start telling people about your organization and how to find this information. And I just, again, appreciate your time today. And thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you. And thank you for all the work that FACT does also. It's just, we all need to work together in our patient community. So I'm happy to work with you. And I've known Eleanor for quite some time. So I know that her work is great also.
Well, I wholeheartedly agree, but I'm very biased. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Before we sign off, I just want to give another thank you to Genentech for being a kind and generous sponsor. Thank you for listening to FACT's Roundtable Podcast. Stay tuned for future episodes coming soon. Please subscribe, leave a review, and listen to our podcast on Pandora, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and Stitcher. Have a great day and always be kind to one another.